Quick Draw.
24 Tage, 24 Menschen, 24 Geschichten. Ein Podcast-Adventskalender des österreichischen Gewerbevereins ÖGV und der Podcast-Agentur Quick Draw. Diese Folge entsteht mit Unterstützung des ÖGV, österreichischer Gewerbeverein, der ältesten Interessensvertretung für Unternehmerinnen und Unternehmer in Österreich.
Einen wunderschönen guten Morgen wünsche ich. Mein Name ist Sascha Ladurner und ich freue mich, Sie in diesen Montag, den 8. Dezember, begleiten zu dürfen. Falls Ihnen am heutigen Feiertag in Wien eine junge Dame entgegenkommt, die an der einen Hand ihren Hund an der Leine hält und mit der anderen versucht, einen Roboter unter Kontrolle zu halten, erschrecken Sie nicht. Sie sind nicht in den Dreh eines Science-Fiction-Films geraten, sondern vermutlich gerade Emily Kate Janatowski begegnet. Sie lebt zu Forschungszwecken mit einem humanoiden Roboter zusammen. In der heutigen Folge erklärt uns Emily, wie sich so ein Roboter im echten Alltag schlägt und wie gefährlich zum Beispiel Stiegensteigen ist, warum der Roboter keine Monatskarte bei den Wiener Linien kaufen darf und wie die Haushaltsversicherung das alles für einen schlechten Scherz hält. Wir sprechen über Europas Rolle zwischen den USA und China, über Datenschutz, den EU-AI-Act und stellen uns die Frage, wer entscheidet eigentlich, wie viel Robotik wir in unserem Leben überhaupt wollen? Emily Janatowski hat übrigens sowohl auf der renommierten Columbia University als auch in Harvard einen Abschluss gemacht. Nur Deutsch wurde ihr als Amerikanerin nicht in die Wiege gelegt. Deshalb führen wir das Interview in Englisch. Auf unserer Website 24geschichten.at finden Sie eine deutschsprachige Zusammenfassung des Gesprächs. Aber jetzt Bühne frei für Emily Kate Janatowski. Vor dem Interview hören Sie noch eine kurze Information des österreichischen Gewerbevereins.
Eine Information des österreichischen Gewerbevereins.
Für Unternehmerinnen und Unternehmer ist Selbstreflexion nicht nur selbstverständlich, sondern eigentlich überlebenswichtig. Jetzt würde mich interessieren, macht das der österreichische Gewerbeverein eigentlich auch? Und das frage ich jetzt einfach mal ÖGV-Generalsekretär Stefan Blahut. Stefan, denkt ihr eigentlich auch darüber nach, was ihr getan habt und wie ihr das in Zukunft besser machen könnt? Und wenn es jetzt nur eine Sache gäbe, die du am ÖGV ändern könntest, was wäre das?
Ja, natürlich denken wir darüber nach, was wir besser machen können. Der ÖGV muss schneller werden. Also das ist einfach der Zug der Zeit. Viele Dinge werden automatisiert, können automatisiert werden. Und da muss auch ein Verein, der die Dienstleistung, Veranstaltung, Austausch, Vertrauensaufbau etc. anbietet, einfach viel flotter werden. Das müssen wir uns vornehmen, das müssen wir auch besser hinkriegen. Dafür braucht es aber umgekehrt auch aktive Mitglieder und wie gesagt, alle unsere Mitglieder haben ja ein Leben neben dem Verein auch. Familie, Beruf, Hobbys, alles wichtiger als der österreichische Gewerbeverein. Und da, wenn wir schneller werden, wenn wir cleverere Angebote haben, wenn uns dann gelingt, dass wir bei den Mitgliedern die Prioritätenliste 30 verlassen und Richtung 15, vielleicht in die 10er, tiefen 10er kommen, da wäre schon viel gewonnen.
A very warm welcome to Emily Kate Janatowski at our podcast. Thanks a lot, and we are appreciating your time. Emily, we are giving all our guests the opportunity to introduce themselves. So would you be so kind and tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
Absolutely. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me. My name is Emily Janatowski, and I am a domestic AI robotics researcher. So I actually live full-time with a domestic robot in my house. It's a humanoid robot. And as well, I am also a doctoral candidate at the University of Vienna. And I speak and write and in general just share my experience and hopefully will help inform other people how to develop their own views on how they feel about domestic robotics.
Okay, so the most important questions for everyone is, will I still see the rise of the machines, or is that more a problem for my kids?
Then you will see. I think right now we're in such an awesome time because we've got all of the hype, we've got all of the attention, and we're still so far behind technically. So we still have a really long way to go. But since we have so many eyeballs on this sort of issue of the rise of the machines, we're sort of able to hammer out all of the issues before they really become capable enough. So I would say that we can shoulder the burden of all of the debates, and then the kids can enjoy the fruits of that labor.
That's good to hear. But now you said you really live with a humanoid robot in your home. So what is that all about? Or can you tell us how it is living with a robot? Is it like having a dog, or is it like having a kid, or is it in between, or is it something totally different?
It is like having the most frustrating piece of machinery ever in your household at the moment. So everybody always asks, is it a partner, a roommate, is it a pet or a kid? It's sort of like having a toddler, in a way, because it runs into everything. It's very hard to control. It's kind of crazy. But it is definitely an experience that is quite unique because, like I said, I mean, we're still so far away from them actually being helpful that right now it's more about what I call the comedy of errors. So finding all of the pain points, finding all of the failure points, and then trying to bring those topics with humor, with personality, with connection to other people and say, okay, if this were you, you know, what would you do? How would you handle this? And I'm talking about things that are either regulatory, legislative, cultural, societal, these different issues that come up. But right now, it's just frustrating on a day-to-day basis because it can't do too much and it can't do anything well yet. But it's a super interesting experience.
Yeah, that gives me an answer to another question because I really wanted to ask you how capable it is for helping in the daily life stuff. But it sounds now it's not really a help. It's more work for you and for your research.
Absolutely. I like to joke. Everyone says, does it get you your morning coffee? And I always hold up the battery and I say, no, I get it. It's morning coffee every morning. it's not very helpful, obviously, around the house at this point. It is definitely more work to have it, you know, carry something or do anything than just going and getting it myself. So it's definitely on the capacity side, not ready, but that was the exact sort of inflection point that I wanted to get ahead of in terms of raising all of these different debates that are these societal, regulatory, cultural debates. Because once they actually reach the point where they are so helpful that they will reach a mass market appeal, it's going to be too late to bring these topics up and bring them forth for public discourse. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of in the line of fire in that way where I have this sort of slightly useless robot and the use of this project being just being able to get out there and talk about these things ahead of time before we're all confronted with it.
And with whom are you working together in this project? So how can I imagine that you have this robot at your home, you're doing stuff with him. So who's getting all the information and trying to make him better? Because I assume you're not the one who's writing the programs and the code behind the scenery.
You would be correct. I am a humanist and I always say, people always say, oh my gosh, you built this robot. I say, no. So I customized it, but other people have built it. So I work with an engineer. And the engineer sort of tries to adapt some of the programming in order to develop some skills. And then I also work, interestingly enough, with some legal professionals in terms of discussion about different topics surrounding regulatory measures. some people who have worked on the EU AI Act, and it's a very interesting sort of group. And then I also, interestingly enough, when I think about my team, it's so many people because this really is a systems act. So inviting this robot into my home and into my life, I routinely say, you know, okay, my dog is one of the first, if not the first dog to live with a robot. My friends take it, you know, for matcha and go take it out to dinner. And my neighbors always walk past and say, oh, where's the robot? We want to come and say hi to the robot. So there's a sort of everyone is involved in some way, and it's not as isolated as being sort of in a lab or something like that. I've really tried to make it a community topic, to include my friends, include my family. So the team, if we shall define it, is quite large. And especially because it's very difficult to maneuver the robot, especially if we have to bring it to an event or something like that. Oftentimes my neighbors get a knock at the door and I say, please, I need your help bringing it down the stairs. Please help me. So we have a lot of people involved, which is very funny.
It's a heavy one, so you can't put it downstairs yourself. So you really need help if that happens.
I really do. I need help. We've had, you know, some very, you know, it's constantly being updated. I will say that. So sometimes there are updates that are better and sometimes there are updates that are worse. And we had one update where I was trying to walk it down the stairs, and this did not go well, and it wound up triggering the kill switch. So the eyes went red and it went limp, and I was underneath it on the stairs, and my neighbor came and found me and was like, are you okay? Like, you're pinned down by a robot on the stairs. So we have a lot of very fascinating things going on. But it actually, when I need to bring it to an event, to a speaking engagement, to a conference, I put it into, which is actually what it's in right now, in a giant travel case that is kind of up to my chest height, and it doubles over. So its head and its legs sort of double over together to pack it very, very carefully so that it doesn't move during transit. And that is oftentimes how it is actually moved from location to location when it has an appearance or needs to go in for checks. And so this I absolutely cannot lift alone. And I had a very funny experience where I was coming back from the TED Talk, and it was really late at night, and I was getting it out of the back of a van, and the handle broke off from the travel case. Ooh. And I was so exhausted. I didn't know what to do. And I live next to like an Irish pub. And I just went into the Irish pub. I said, can anybody, any strong people come out and help me with this? And all these guys came out with their pints of beer and helped me to move this giant case with the robot into my house. And then one of them said, well, what's inside of this? And I said, oh, it's a robot. And they didn't believe me. And they were like, there's no way we're moving the robot right now. It was such a funny experience. And then I opened the case for them and I said, no, really, look. And they were like, this is the craziest night ever.
So it's also helps socializing in a very special way.
It absolutely does. It makes you
more than a cat can do.
Yeah, exactly. Makes you very comfortable asking for help. I will say that much, because you're just in a situation where you need it. You absolutely need it.
I've heard a very fun story about you also asking the Wiener Linien if your robot needs a ticket if he rides with you. So what did the Wiener Linien say at that point?
This was a wild story. I was realizing, you know, that I have to order these giant vans. I have to pack it away. And for transport, I need to, you know, put it in this box. And I thought, you know, it's got legs. It's got a body. It has the capacity to walk and sit. So why wouldn't it just come with me on the tram? And I was thinking, okay, I need to figure out, I guess, a ticket, because if it does sit, it's taking up a seat. And I asked, and the Wiener Linien policy is that if you want to get an annual ticket, you need to have like a registration at a home in Vienna. And this led me then to try to register it at my home in Vienna. And I mean, the comedy of errors of the bureaucracy of this is so fantastically amusing and so ridiculous at this point. But it's just kind of funny to go through the motions, to ask these people and see on their faces, what are you talking about? A ticket for a humanoid robot.
Yeah, because they don't believe you if you ask something
like that. Yes, nobody believes me. I got hung up on by my insurance agency because I called them. I said, I need to raise my insurance. You know, I need my home insurance to be, beefed up. I need more because this thing is, you know, clunking around my house. And they hung up on me because they thought I was pranking them. And when I said, I have a humanoid robot living at my house, it's bashing up all of my furniture and everything like this. And they just hung up on me right away. So it's hard to get people to believe you when you're talking about it. But I think the great thing is that these stories do bring humor. They bring sort of this fantastical element. And then it becomes a discussion. You know, should they have a ticket on the tram? I think yes, because they're taking up a seat and they're using this this service that's provided, you know, by the city that is a paid service. And in the same way that maybe we need to develop some very interesting insurance policies for autonomous robotics. If they're acting alone, who's responsible? Who's taking out the insurance? Is it the robot who's responsible? Yeah. Is it the owner of the robot? Is it the company? So there are so many fascinating questions that just run into just by living life and being curious and not being afraid to call up and ask if you can have a ticket for a robot.
And the robot you live with, is this a prototype or is this some piece of work which is really built in bigger numbers for research?
This is a great question, and it's sort of a complex question as well, because I work with a lab in China. It's called Unitree Labs, Unitree Robotics, and this product, technically speaking, is available still as sort of a prototype, as a research product. But I went through about a 3 to 4 month process of completely customizing this robot because there are very different regulatory landscapes within where it's produced, which is in China, and then for operation and use here in the EU. So there are regulations like the GDPR. So we needed to make sure that there's no data that's stored, that if there is any data that is temporarily stored, that it's stored on servers that are located here within the EU. For the EU AI Act, we had to go through a whole process of sort of understanding what the risk factors are, trying to mitigate those risks. Obviously, there's no biometric data that's taken. So there was a very interesting process of being able to dive really deep into the minutiae of the laws of this landscape and then adapt a product that was originally designed and manufactured specifically for a very different regulatory landscape where the concept of surveillance or human dignity or privacy or these types of things are not necessarily as top of mind as they are here for the regulation.
And what are you doing with this thing? you have it at home and then what? You put the on button in the morning and what happens next?
So I do like to take my dog out for a walk every morning, and I like to bring it as many times as I can with me because it's really about observing how people interact with it, what comes up about the interactions. So we will go on a walk with my little dog in the morning time, go out into the square. I live on a beautiful Viennese square. And I observe how people interact. I observe there's very interesting differentiation between different cultures, different age groups, gender, all of these different aspects that influence how people interact with it. And then I try my best to include it in my daily life. And that's sort of where a lot of these sort of humorous comedy of errors issues happen, like going on the tram, like trying to bring it to my office at the university, like trying to bring it to a workout class with me and my friends, or trying to bring it to a coffee shop or out to dinner and on a rooftop. You know, I try to include it as much as I can in daily life just to see what comes up, to see what are the issues, what would be the barrier to an example if, you know, let's say right now I have one and maybe there's one or two others that are in Europe right now. What happens when we have 50,000 or 100,000 across Europe? We're going to be looking at very different questions. So as much as I can try to get ahead of that in a responsible and thoughtful way, that's really what I try to do. But like I said, in terms of around the house, it's not a super help yet. It's not doing my dishes. It's not doing my laundry. I'm all on my own for all of that. But I do try to incorporate it into daily life.
And then with all that information, what happens with this information? You're working in a team, you said. I think it's in a university environment, something like that. What's the next step you're trying to do with all this information?
So my work with the university is about AI and is about digital technology and legacy institutions. However, this robotics project is actually entirely independent and privately funded. So I'm very lucky that I sort of get to determine the routes that we go with the project. And really, it's about engaging in public discourse at the moment. So writing, doing interviews, doing speeches, and trying to just get sort of these conversations out into the open is the main focus right now. I also keep, obviously, very detailed notes when it comes to technical issues in terms of working with the engineers and trying to develop the capacities of what it really can do. But on the side of this sort of cultural discourse, the things like this is the whole point, is to bring these topics to people, tell stories, get people thinking about what it will mean in the future and how what landscape people want to see for their own communities, for their own homes and families and friendship circles and their nation.
Very interesting. So what do you think, if you see the future in, I don't know, 10 for 20 years, will there be robots like being normal in all our lives, or is this still a long way to go because of the technical issues, or more about the legal issues or the issues in the society, because a lot of people, they're still scared of that? I mean, my generation, we grew up with Matrix, you know, the film where where we were just used as superfood or something like that. Yeah. So it's really hard to tell how people react in all that things, yeah?
Absolutely. I think that hopefully projects like this will help to ease adoption. So I think the more people feel that they have a say, the more control people have over how robotics are integrated into their communities, I think we'll find easier adoption. I do think that they will become commonplace. And in the same way that, you know, we were absolutely amazed by the iPhone or Meta glasses and things, then become commonplace. They become a lot more normal. They become integrated into society. I think this will happen. But I do think maybe 15 to 20 years is a decent time frame for that. But I also am aware that this will look very different in different communities. So something that I often do discuss very openly, considering I am an American researcher, I'm very grateful to be operating here in the EU under the EU regulations, and I work with a robot that is from the Chinese landscape. I think that for that reason, I'm sort of hyper aware of the differences in culture, of the differences in regulation and priorities. So I do think that there will be areas where it's more commonplace. And I think that we're actually going to see areas where people outright reject the concept that they want to specifically regulate to not allow to have robotics or AI components that are within their communities and driving certain social or cultural factors. And I think that's fantastic. I think people should have the right to choose what surrounds them, because it's very, very difficult to opt out. I think that it should be opt-in. I think that people should have the ability to say that there will not be in their community or in their home or in their apartment building. And this is something that I've spoken about, is that we have these options ahead of us right now. We can say that we are looking to have it be a policy of a building or business. We can say, no, you know, just as we say no pets allowed in the supermarket, or there are certain buildings that you can rent in where they say, no, we don't allow pets. We can absolutely have that as an option. We have areas, I use the example always of like e-scooters and e-bikes. and how there are certain areas where these are permitted and there are certain areas where these are not permitted. And that's absolutely fine as well. We can have no-go zones. This could be schools, churches, certain neighborhoods that just have decided to make this a policy. So I think we have so many options in front of us right now, and we're at such a perfect time to be having these discussions, to develop our own ideas. Again, I try never to push my own ideas on this onto the project or onto the discourse, because I want people to think about it critically and decide for themselves. Decide on an individual, family, household, neighborhood, country level what it is that they feel comfortable with. And because we are still so early, we can decide. So I think that there will probably be clear delineations where these pieces of technology are embraced, and then areas where it's completely rejected, and people are going to sort of fall into these categories, I think, and decide for themselves and be able to have their privacy if that's what they want, or to have the convenience if that's what they want. But it's always going to be a trade-off.
You said a very interesting sentence before, that you are very happy to work under the regulations here in the EU as a scientist. When you see the differences between the US, Europe, or then China, and you compare it to each other, what do you think, what are the chances Europe will have in AI, in robotic, compared to the US or the Chinese or the Asian market? I don't want to say it's China alone, because I think there are much bigger differences than only the rules that appear. Also, society, culture, and how people connect with new technologies. I always think in the United States, people are much more open-minded for new technologies than we are here in Europe. We are always, we forbid something and then we have a look what happens. And it makes us sometimes slow, because so it's the first time I heard someone really say, I'm glad we work under all these regulations. That's a thing no entrepreneur or something would like to say.
I know that this is a unique view. I see it as a really fantastic challenge. And I was speaking with some during this sort of 3-4 month period that I referenced earlier, where I was sort of going through this absolute jungle of trying to balance regulatory compliance with the best capacities that this product could have when it came to live with me. I had so many people from I used to be in the tech world in America. I was at Google for many years, and I had so many people who I knew from the tech world who just said, "Why are you even asking? Like, just do it. Just order, you know, with all the capacities and apologize later." And I was like, "No, this is not how we're going to do this. First of all, I'm a researcher. I'm a guest. I'm a guest here in this beautiful country, in this beautiful EU." And I was very sort of committed to understanding the minutia of this landscape and of the culture, and trying to find ways to bring that together. There were a few topics here, and one of them is actually very interesting, which is that in the US, because there are a lot fewer protections for people and their data, the questions and the interactions that I receive from Americans versus from Europeans are very different, because Europeans come at this already knowing we're protected, our data is protected. And I think that that's really fascinating, because the questions from the US based people that I speak to about this project are all, "Oh, I bet it's, you know, turning on and watching you at night. I bet it's collecting all of your data. I bet it's doing all these things." And they're not progressing sometimes to the next question. They're not progressing into societal cohesion. They're not progressing into culture. They're not progressing into regulation like that. They're so concerned with the data. And I understand why. Because of the regulatory landscape they're under, because of the culture that they're under, because of the economic system that they're under, this is top of mind. I find it super fascinating that when I speak to Europeans, they do talk about other aspects. They talk about labor displacement and how this the adoption of robotics will influence the social welfare system here. They talk about a lot of different aspects. And for me, that is such a beautiful sort of meat and potatoes discussion of what I'm trying to get at. And they talk about social cohesion. They talk about personal connectivity and what will this do to our relationships? What will this do to our family units? And I think that there is something so beautiful about the fact that people here within the EU are so protected. EU AI Act, GDPR, they are protected. Their data is protected. They know that when something, when a product does come in, that this will be taken care of on a higher governmental level, that it's not going to be on the company to act in a responsible way, that this is enforced for their own protection and dignity. And I think that it is such a beautiful concept for me that this question is to the side for the moment because people feel protected and that we can discuss all of these other sort of humanistic components, societal components that are separate. So I do really see this beautiful value in people who live under these protections and these laws and what they're thinking when it comes to technology is so delicious because they're not, you know, innovation for innovation's sake. It's how is it actually going to fit in? It's not about the economic opportunity that it presents. It's not about the governmental control that it could be indicating. It's not about any of these things that exist in other landscapes. It's very humanistic. And I'm super grateful that I get a chance to discuss these types of matters with people where it is their first quality of life or human dignity or social cohesion. When this is top of mind, this is an incredible opportunity for me as a researcher and really, really sort of hones in on what I'm hoping to get out of this project. So I do love it. I do love the challenge. I love the perspective. And I think it's just such a fantastic fantastic place to be. And I feel grateful as an American that I get to be here.
That's amazing to hear because I think what you just said is something here in Europe is not so much appreciated, obviously, as it is from people coming inside the EU, because we are most of the time are complaining about all the rules we have. Yeah, for everything we need a rule. And like you said before, if you want to register something, we have a very popular comic. I don't know if you ever heard about Asterix and Obelix.
I actually have one of the books there.
It's a French comic, and there's one very popular scene in the house who makes madness. Yeah, you know, and they need a formula, and to get this formula, you need another formula. But for that formula, you need the other one.
Yes.
You don't have because you need the other one, and they are. It's driving people crazy, yeah, and that's what we often think. But in the view you just told us, that's completely different view, and maybe we should focus more on that view sometimes. Mm-hmm. Step back and see the whole picture because it's really good. Emily, before we come to the end, I want to ask a personal question because I have seen, and you said it, you are from the United States. You studied in Columbia, you studied in Harvard, and I've seen you have a master's degree in museology and museum studies.
Yes.
So I want to ask you two questions. First, how did you came to AI and robotics?
Mm-hmm.
And the second one, how did you end up in Vienna? Is that something where we have to say thank you to Donald Trump or has it different reasons?
I think we have to thank my grandma. My grandma is from the Austro-Hungarian Empire and she actually left
really?
To come for school. Yeah.
Okay, that explains the name, of course.
That explains the name. We got it. Yeah, so my grandma actually lived here until she was 18. And then she went to America. She met my grandfather, and they obviously had their family in America, in New York, actually. And, you know, my mom brought me back here, and I absolutely fell in love with the architecture, with the nature, with the culture, and the accessibility of the city. And I moved here for a few months to sort of test it out. This was pre-COVID, to test it out and see how I liked it. And obviously, it's the most livable city in the world. It's a huge honor and a pleasure to live life here. So I was very enamored by the access to culture, by the ease of transport, by all of the different components that make this city so wonderful. And then when COVID hit and I knew that I was going to be getting my doctorate at some point, I thought, it's now or never. Let's take the leap. And I wound up here and I'm so happy that I did, because everyone says I should work for the tourist board because I absolutely love Vienna and I love living in Austria. So it's my great pleasure to be here. But it's a family connection as well. And so that is how I wound up here. And how I wound up in AI is also very interesting. I've always sort of been at this intersection between technology and culture. So in my undergraduate, it was about digital public history. And so this was this component about, you know, having these classic research methods and then having a very sort of public discourse surrounding them and making content online and getting people interested and engaged with history. And in my master's, it was the same. So I specialized in digital aspects of museum management. So content management systems and website backends and campaigns online. So everything has always been sort of about taking very traditional academic aspects and then bringing them to the public through digital means. And I do definitely see my work now as a continuation of that. I'm working in the home. I'm working with sort of very traditional institutions, with academic institutions, working within the home, the oldest institution, and then sort of discussing and bringing that about. And in terms of how I got to AI, so I was at Google for many years, and I managed for Google Arts and Culture. So within this, this was sort of the perfect meeting place of sort of my cultural background and then my digital background, where I managed a lot of digitization projects for the North American branch of Google Arts and Culture, and then a lot of sort of the educational aspects as well. And in this, I worked with the lab in Paris on a few at Google Arts and Culture on a few projects that had to do with natural language processing first, and then other AI components. And I sort of got this taste just within the confines of my job that I already was managing. And this was, I would say, maybe now about like 8 years ago. So this was a while back, and we were working with these products. We were working with people who we were really bumbling around a lot, because this was a time when we were running into a lot of issues. And this gave me a good perspective on how to view what I think people would term failure or pain points in early adoption and in sort of deploying a piece of technology into an application and having every single thing go wrong. And embracing it and saying, oh, we found something that went wrong. Great. Let's attack it. Let's fix it. Let's figure out what went wrong. Let's figure out how we can change the underlying technology so that it fits with our application and that we can, you know, send out either a product or a project and be confident in it as it reaches the public. So this was a really sort of fantastic era to be in the mix at Google, for sure, when we were starting to deploy all of these different pieces of technology. And then from there, I had a love for AI, because I was working with sort of this early development and early application of it. And then funnily enough, the way that I went from AI to AI robotics is that I was following all of these AI discussions online, and I saw a TikTok about AI robotics and humanoid robotics in the home. And it piqued my interest, and I was thinking about it for days. And I actually contacted, just through the like form on the website, I contacted Unitree first, the ones that I actually work with now. And I said, you know, I have a little dog and she's so small. And I wonder, like, how do the robots interact with the dogs in the home if you're bringing them to the homes? And they said, oh, we have no idea. Our robots have never met a dog. And I said, well, that feels like a small oversight. And I think maybe we should talk. And I was asking you about, you know, all of these different components that have to do with like everyday life in the home. I was, as you can see, If you can see, I have a lot of antiques in my house. This is a very delicate home. I have a lot of friends who have recently had beautiful babies. And so I was asking about all of these different questions, dogs and children and guests and antiques and delicate items. And the answer coming back from everything was, well, we actually never tested that. And I thought, well, you are not ready to go to market in the West. Let's discuss. So I'm happy to say it was a TikTok video and my love for my beautiful little Pomeranian that brought me down this road to saying, listen, you guys need somebody to come in and actually live daily life with one of these things, because you can't go to market without these things worked out. And so I'm sort of gathering all of this information and understanding how, you know, the home is this chaotic, messy place where, you know, there's things on the floor. Okay, it trips if there's a Lego on the floor. That's a problem if you, you know, if you have little kids, or, you know, my dog will put a treat under the carpet and make the carpet, you know, stand up a little bit. It trips and falls over. These are real world issues that we really need to get out ahead of. So that is sort of my very winding path towards AI robotics research, but that's how it happens. That's how it happens.
Cool story. Well, Emily, I think we could talk much longer, and I'm pretty sure we will do it again, because it's a real interesting theme. And I'm very glad you took a little bit of the miss and and the fear out of this robotic theme. I think most of us still have. So it was really good talking to you, and I really appreciate your input and your knowledge. So thank you very much. Christmas is just in front of us. So if you have one wish for robotics or something like that, what would it be?
That's such a good question. I would say that people are open to discussion, that people are open to chatting about it, to meeting a robot, and to talking about it over the dinner table with their family and figuring out what their own views are, and then engaging and getting involved in the process before they're all here. So that would be my main wish.
So, yes, and to all our listeners, if you see a nice young woman walking with a robot here in Vienna, it's not the Spritzer you had, it's real.
It's true.
Thanks a lot for talking to us, Emily.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for having me.